Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And we have another jam-packed, exciting episode. At least we think it's exciting. What we want to talk about today is the new Dexcom G7 integration with some of our insulin pumps. And then also ADA standards of care for 2024 were just released. We don't possibly have enough time to talk about all of the exciting updates in one episode, but we are going to share some of our high-level things that we're excited about. So let's go ahead and dive right in. Natalie, I'm going to throw it to you to talk about G7 integration and what we're seeing now.
So in the last few weeks, we've had both Tandem as well as the iLet insulin pumps announced that G7 is now integrated. By the time this episode airs, both of them will be publicly available, and we're really excited. Why? Because of the things we love about G7. One, that you can hop from one sensor to the other with a 25-minute warm-up. And what does that mean? So they've reduced it to 26 minutes, technically, a warm-up phase. So that, you know, those 2 hours that you're waiting for G6 versus G7 is gone. It's down to 26 minutes. The second thing that I love is that you can put a new G7 in and get it started while your old G6 is finishing that time. So you can go from one sensor to the other with zero interruption. And I think that we don't think about that interruption time enough. I know that lots of people say, I don't check, but if I eat, I bolus for the carbs. And there's just that little gap. And I think that if we can avoid those gaps, we will, you know, it's just better for all of us that use insulin AID systems for diabetes. So that's a big part of why I'm excited. But also, you're going to be able to choose whether or not you're using G6 or G7, so that if your insulin pump or your insurance says you continue to need to use G6 and you don't have access to G7, the day you upgrade, you can go back and forth as often as you want. Every time you pick a sensor, you're going to be able to tell it which one you're using. So those are my big highlights.
Yeah, well, I'm totally in agreement with you. I think it's awesome giving people the choice. And people can choose. A lot of people are very excited to make the upgrade and switch to G7. But I know there's some people out there that want to continue with their G6. One of the interesting things, and we could talk off label because why not, is the fact that with G6, there are ways to reuse your sensor. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not ideal practice, right? Because it's designed for the 10 days. But what really happens in the real world is that people don't get their refills on time, that goes through, maybe it's going through DME and there's a delay because there was a paperwork that didn't get received. Who knows? There's a million reasons. Or the sensors just run out early and someone, like, they're getting a hard time about getting a new batch of them. So being able to reuse them allows people to stockpile them a little bit. So there may be some people that just don't want to switch because they've got a stockpile, but also you can't, or at least, no, I'm not aware of a way to restart a G7 sensor now that we have that fully disposable transmitter. So that could be a reason people may choose to stay with that regardless. I just love people having choices. Also, to your point about the shorter warm-up, that will allow people to consistently be in closed loop, to put on a new sensor before the other ones even stop and have no time out of the closed loop. And I think where this is especially is going to be important is with the Beta Bionics iLet. Because that pump is very unique in that there is no manual mode. There is really... It only knows automation. And so when a person doesn't have a CGM and doesn't have a CGM for a long period of time, they need to do some finger sticks. And so that will remove this burden of needing to do any finger sticks because they would have no interruption from that closed loop at all. So I think I was pretty surprised to hear the news that it's already working with iLet. Because I thought that was going to take a lot longer. I thought that would be sometime in 2024. And so I'm thrilled that integration is coming so soon. And like you said, hopefully, maybe not right when this episode airs, but hopefully like very shortly after it will be commercially available and people will be able to use that.
And so our third company that hasn't done the upgrade yet is Omnipod. And we are waiting. They have told publicly, they have said early 2024, they are the last company that uses Dexcom as their AID continuous glucose sensor. So we are waiting for their, you know, they did announce iPhone at availability, and it hasn't happened yet, but we're expecting that in very early 2024, followed hopefully very quickly by the G7 integration.
Yeah. And as long as we're kind of talking about all the pumps, I want to mention, so Medtronic 780G, which we've had a lot of people switch to, very happy with the upgrade from the previous Medtronic pumps. But one thing about their sensor is that it's a transmitter that does need to be charged each 7 days after it's removed. And also the sensor for the insertion, it has actually a separate device that you use to load it and to insert it. So recently I have run into issues with some of my patients where I'm like, wait a second, why don't you have CGM on for 24 hours? And what's happening is, like, maybe it's going off, it stops working when they're at work. Well, they don't have their charger with them. They don't have that insertion device with them. Like, they don't have all the things that you need. And so it ends up, by the time they get home, like, they don't want to change it right at night. And so it ends up being like a whole day. And so, unfortunately, you know, Medtronic isn't working with Dexcom, so we're not going to see that integration. But what we do hope to see in 2024 is that Medtronic will have a new sensor. It was approved in Europe. That's going to be more like the G7, Libre 2, Libre 3, where it's disposable. And so I'm hopeful that may also kind of take away some of that burden and help people stay in closed loop more time.
And we're, you know, that is, first of all, we're using Medtronic 780 as well, loving it, right? Loving the algorithm. And the CGM is coming. We know this. We've heard really good reports out of Europe with the new Simplera, is what it's called there. And you and I will be able to report more on that when we are at ATTD in late February, early March in Florence.
Yeah, can't wait for that. So speaking of all of these insulin pumps and automated insulin delivery and everything, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the new things in the standards of care. And one of the things that really excited me is just this push to introduce diabetes technology earlier in people's diagnosis, and especially like CGM right away, like especially for type 1. But even now, there's more information in type 2 about the benefits of starting it early with diagnosis. But also when it comes to automated insulin delivery, like, hands down, it is superior to multiple daily injections of insulin. It's just, I mean, I love using all the tools. I love connected pens. I love all the things. But the reality is that it's just automation really makes things a lot easier. Adjusting doses.
Constantly, right? Constantly. And AID just improves overall. You know, I tell people, you're going to wake up close to 100, depending on what we set your target at overnight, obviously, right? Every day, they fix it. If you go to bed a little high, it brings it down. You go to bed a little low, it brings it up. It's bringing you into range. And we've all talked about for years now how if you start the day off in the range that you want to be, the rest of the day just is better. So the idea that this is encouraged earlier, we should be offering this at as close to at diagnosis as we can within reason, and with, in the US at least, insurance company approval.
Yeah, which is, I would say, getting better and better for type
1. I think so as well.
Right.
Yep. In the past, it used to be, you know, you had to have type 1 for 6 months. Like, it was almost like it was going to go away. And that's really gone to the wayside now. So most insurance companies cover it very, very quickly after diagnosis.
Yeah. And so I think the key thing here is that it should be offered to people, especially evidence is very robust for type 1 diabetes, although guidelines still support anyone with any type of insulin dependent diabetes can benefit from this technology. Now, there's always going to be some people that don't want to use it, or time periods in people's lives where they don't want to be connected. They don't want to utilize it for whatever reason. And that's fine. That's why it's great that we do have the other tools. We have the connected pens and pen caps. We have the inhaled insulin. Like, I am thrilled. Not every single person is going to use it, but every person should be offered it.
Right.
And I don't think every person is being offered it. I think there's a lot of factors, and some of them, really, we shouldn't be judging people by anything. We should be offering them all the tools that we have and then letting them make the decision if they want to use it or not.
And I think all of us as clinicians have been surprised at some of the outcomes that we see when we, you know, we have to recognize that there is clinical bias in everybody. There is. And so, you know, you think, all right, I'm going to start this person. I wonder how they're going to do, though. And they do fabulously. Yeah. We cannot, we really do have to say, technology is offered at every visit. I mean, I have people, when I walk in the room, I know you're going to want me to get on a pump, and I don't want one. I'm never going to make you do anything. I want you to choose. Here are all the options. Here's inhaled insulin. Here's a smart pen. Here's a smart, you know, an AID system. We just got to get the insulin in your body. How you choose to do that is up to you. But I think we've all, you know, at various parts of our career, kind of held back on, you know, it used to be you had to be this and you had to be that and you had to be. Now it's like, wait a minute. If we can improve that time and range, if we can improve, reduce the risk of complications, maybe not everyone's going to get an A1C of 6.2. But that's not the goal. The goal is to do lots of things. Reduce the risk of long-term complications. Reduce the burden for the person. You know, I think people forget. I see lots of split insulin use, and it's like, you're taking basal alone twice a day. Why don't we do it this way? Why can't I offer you? We really need to be thinking, how is this like to live with this every day and offer technology very early on?
I totally agree. And the real world data with these systems has also been so positive, along with, of course, the clinical trial data. So that's really why our guidelines are so supportive. And we continue to see the standards of care each year advocate these even more as an early option for people with diabetes. So along those lines, another update. So I'm very interested in the diabetes and pregnancy space. And this past year, of course, we had 3 CGMs that were FDA cleared for use in pregnancy, the Dexcom G7, Libre 2, and Libre 3. So ADA standards of care referenced that. And I would say beefed up some of their language about the use of CGM in pregnancy. I was also happy that there was in the narrative a reference to the use of AID in pregnancy, which in the U.S. at least is not FDA approved, but of course, tons of us are using it. And so it's good that they acknowledged it and how, even though the targets aren't necessarily made for pregnancy, often we can work with these systems and achieve better outcomes than without using AID at all. But one of the things that the standards of care continue to say is about the fact that we should have people continue to do finger sticks with the use of CGM. And I understand why they say that, because the landmark trial that studied CGM in pregnancy was called CONCEPT. And in that trial, people had to do finger sticks. They had to do finger stick calibrations, and they were advised to do at least 4 finger sticks a day. But one of the things I don't know that everyone knows about is what CGM was used in the CONCEPT trial. And keep in mind, this was years and years ago that this trial was done. The CGM used was actually the Medtronic Guardian, or the older version of the Guardian. So it required calibration. Like, you had to do it because that's the way the CGM is designed. Our current systems don't require calibration. Then some of them can't be calibrated, right? Like Libre, you just can't. So that being said, I agree that some finger stick confirmations are likely should be done, because CGM is not perfect all the time. And in pregnancy, when I need a person to be under 95 overnight, that's very different than 110. And a finger stick can be helpful to determine that. But 4 finger sticks a day, think of the burden on people.
Right. Right. Here we are back to the burden of what we're asking someone to do, right? So to me, when would I really want those finger sticks? Probably overnight, right? As often as we can within reason. So now I'm waking somebody up. So could you do it every other night or 3 nights a week, and you tell me when? If you go to bed exhausted and you just need a break, don't get up and do it, right? We have to keep the person. A lot of people who are pregnant have full-time jobs. They're parents. They're caregivers for their parents. They're doing all kinds of things. They're not sitting at home growing a baby. So we need to keep that reasonable. the times I would really like to see another finger stick is not before a meal. That the chances are very good that before a meal, they're actually, because they haven't eaten in a while, probably the finger stick will match that CGM. But I would love to see, if you're going to do them at all, 1 or 2 hours post-meal, so that we can make sure that CGM is reading. But I have to tell you, most of the pregnant patients we see, asking them to do finger sticks on top, I'm at this point asking them to do them when their sensor, if they have a sensor that needs warm-up time in between, for example, those are the times they're actually doing them. They're not doing them 2, 3, 4 times a day. Absolutely not.
I agree. It's just not, it's way too much to ask people to do. And so I think we're still learning what is the right, when are the optimal times to do it. And also even the interpretation of data in pregnancy is very interesting. So we have guidelines for type 1 diabetes in pregnancy that we're aiming for 70% or more between 63 and 140. But I think there's a lack of awareness of necessarily how to make adjustments to achieve the targets. And in pregnancy, it's more than just time in range. Time in range is a great tool outside of pregnancy. But I think that in pregnancy, we especially also need to be aware of, like, what is that average glucose? And are we meeting those postprandial targets and the fast
target
overnight? So it's a little bit more nuanced. And so I think hopefully we'll continue to develop more, I don't know, more expertise than what to look at and how to adjust insulin based on these CGM readings. And that's, I guess that's what I look forward to maybe 2025 standards of care, 2026. But that's, I would say, where some of the gaps are that we need more information.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, again, if we set the target for 263 to 140 and someone's 135 the whole time, technically they're 100% in range,
right,
but their fasting isn't where we want it. Their 1 hour postprandial is, but their 2 hour isn't. So, you know, that extra glucose is passed through the placenta, and that's not, you know, then insulin is made, and that's where we get, you know, babies born that are, you know, over the goal weight. Like, that's what's happening. So we can look at the goals of time and range, just like we can with people without diabetes, but there's no glucose being passed through a placenta at that point, right? So we don't want someone running an average of 172 and staying there all the time without pregnancy and diabetes. We certainly don't want someone with 100% time in range with an average glucose of 135 either. So you're right. We do need to continue to drill down. How do we look at these differently? And do we look at times between, you know, how do we break down those hours of where we are and what the goals are to, you know, just improve outcomes in pregnancy with diabetes? It's amazing to see how many women with type 1 and type 2 who use insulin during pregnancy have phenomenal outcomes now. This wasn't the same 20 years ago. This was not what we have now. It's an amazing, amazing time. So I'm excited to see what comes next as well.
For sure. And the other thing I was just going to say is, like, that whole time in range of 63 to 140, 70%, that is just type 1. So we actually don't even have definitive guidelines for type 2 or gestational diabetes, truly diagnosed in pregnancy. So those are kind of also further areas. I can tell you in practice, we're trying to get much higher than 70%. Often we're able to, but so higher the better. But we don't know exactly, we don't have specific guidance on that. So yeah. So one other thing I'm hoping we can squeeze in today, Natalie, I know you were really excited about the mention of artificial intelligence, AI, specifically for retinopathy screening. So can you tell us about that?
So you know, I think we have to take a step back when we think about screening for retinopathy. Lots of people don't go. I don't know, you know, the exams aren't fun, right? They're uncomfortable. They don't hurt, but it's uncomfortable. Your eye is typically, you are dilated, and then a very, very bright light is, you know, it's shined into the back to look at that retina. And sometimes then a secondary, even brighter light is used. And they say things like, look up, look down, look left, look right, look straight. And then you close your eyes and you're a little bit dizzy and you can see the white lights when you're not even, and then they do the other eye, right? And so you're waiting in a waiting room. You reflect on the last year or the last 6 months or 3 weeks or however long it's been since you've had an exam. And it's emotionally burdensome. It's scary. And then it's not comfortable. And actually, after the exam, it's really hard to see for a while until your retinas, until your pupils, the dilation goes away, right? It's like, so you hope that you go on a day that's cloudy, honestly. So that's what it's like. So what do? You don't go. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable. And you reflect on whether or not, you know, am I a good person or a bad person? Is my diabetes good or bad? We don't talk like that, but it feels that way as a person. So people don't go. So there are now cameras that are used in the primary care and endocrinology space that can get a very good screening exam in an office setting, in an outpatient office setting. We're actually in the midst of buying the cameras for our practice and for all of our hospital systems to use to increase our screening, because the challenge is once the damage starts and is being done, lots of times vision isn't affected for a long time. So there's a gap in the care, and then the treatment, you know, you've built all these complications that we can't reverse versus the ones that we can if we know early on. So, you know, you can use AI. What happens is a picture is taken, an AI can actually do the diagnostic right there and say, does this person need further follow-up? Can they see any retinopathy at all? And so this is an amazing, amazing, amazing. And I think we're not thinking, you and I are so technology focused. We both run our technology programs and we teach and we lecture and we do all these things. But in the end, why are we doing all this technology? Why are we encouraging people to increase their time and range? It's to reduce the complications from diabetes and to live a normal life expectancy. So to me, this is everything. When the American Diabetes Association that guides our clinical practice says, no, this is good. This is great. This can be part of the standards of care.
Yeah. And I think it's awesome because this is actually the first time a recommendation with artificial intelligence.
Yes.
Standards of care. They did allude to this last year in the narrative, but now it's actually in a recommendation to consider using these systems. And I'm just kind of excited to see like the future of where AI is used in other areas. And so I'm hopeful this is just the beginning and, yeah, ultimately to make things easier and increase screening and just help people reduce their chance of complications by checking it early and hopefully treating it early if they have it.
Yes.
Well, I think we are out of time.
Wow. So this is so much, and we have so much more to say. We're going to have to do a second.
We will definitely do another part with the standard.
Yes.
There is absolutely more to say. But I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and we hope you'll catch us on the next episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.